Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, he was just 19 years old, lying wounded in a hospital in Europe when he learned his brother had died fighting in the Pacific. But he summoned the strength to fight on and would be wounded again while carrying a fellow soldier.
You almost lost your life trying to save someone else's.
You do what you have to do, especially somebody wounded like that.
Catch this courageous veteran story today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a show where every week we take a trip back in time. We listen to veterans, primarily from our World War II generation, tell us what they experienced in the service of our country. The idea is to honor them for their service and the sacrifices they made that have paved the way for our freedom. We want to preserve those stories so we don't forget how much our freedom cost. And along the way, we learn quite a bit about what life was like way back when. And today we're going to hear about a little bit of Europe during World War II, including some fierce days in Italy. You're going to learn why the 88th Infantry Division became known as the Blue Devils. And we're going to hear from one of those devils. I don't know if he likes being called a devil, but it's 88-year-old Ruben Ramirez of Reedley, California, originally from Southern California. Mr. Ramirez, what was it like growing up in Southern California? The Los Angeles area wasn't quite so crowded 70 years ago, was it?
It wasn't like the freeway is now. It's terrifying to drive the freeways down there now, where at my time was riding, not cable cars, but streetcars. And we used a streetcar to travel into downtown from the outskirts of the neighborhood.
Did you grow up in a big family down there?
No, it was one brother and two sisters. And the brother was killed in the Philippines in 44. And my one sister passed away 8 years ago, and the other sister still lives in Pomona, so we're the only ones left.
Was that an older brother or younger brother?
Older brother. He was 7 years older than I, and he went into the service in 41, right after the draft started. He got shipped to the Pacific, and I ended up going to Europe.
Well, what do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Do you remember how you got that news?
Three other friends of mine, we were all in the downtown theater in Los Angeles. They announced, they stopped the movie and announced that what had happened to Pearl Harbor and everything else. So they cut the movie and started playing patriotic music, and everybody and the people were just crowding, running outside, you know, with excitement of it. But we just looked at each other and said, well, I guess there's going to be a war. Although we, as kids, we would go to the library and read all about World War I, about the fighting and the airplanes and all that, and then we'd go to a movie. So when that hit us, we were kind of excited about it. We didn't know if we were going to be involved into how deep we were going to be involved.
Well, and I've heard a lot of stories, because I ask everybody that question about December 7th, and that's a pretty unique way to experience that. I think these days, if something like that happened, people would ask for their money back because they didn't get to see the rest of the movie. It doesn't sound like you were doing that.
Nobody thought about money for at that time. Just it was, well, it hit you hard. Because you figure there's got to be another war.
So your older brother goes in shortly thereafter, and I guess you probably had some time still to finish up high school?
I didn't finish high school. I dropped out 11th grade and then went to work. When I came back, I finished my GED testing and everything. I passed that with good grades and everything. I regretted dropping out afterwards, but what was done was done.
Well, I'm curious what it was like to still be here in the States and know your brother was heading overseas. Were you concerned for him? Were you worried about him? Did you keep in touch with him? What was that like?
We more or less kept in contact, and whenever he was assigned to camps around California along the coastline, he was in St. Louis Obispo, Fort Ord, other places that we could travel to. We'd all pile into the car and go and spend a weekend with him.
Kind of sounds like you looked up to him.
We were close. We were very close. His nickname was Hank. His older friends always called me, "Here comes little Hank," because I was like hanging on to his coattail, going to the baseball games and everything. And he took care of me pretty good.
Did you sign up because he was already in, or did you wait to get drafted yourself?
I got drafted. I was 18 in July of 43, and I was in the Army November of 43, so 3 months after my birthday. Went to Camp Roberts, got trained there and everything. Finished my training, we got a 30-day leave, R&R at home, and then we reported to Fort back east, and we got it re-outfitted and everything else. All the group that I trained with at Camp Roberts, we all reported there, got outfitted and everything, and we were there about 2 weeks. And they start calling, fall out in the parade grounds, and they start calling names to get on board trucks. Everybody got on the trucks except me. I was the only one left in the parade grounds, trying to find out where I was supposed to go. And I told the sergeant, "What am I going to do?" He said, "Well, I can't find your name on the list. I can't find your number on the list." So he checked with another officer and up the line, and they finally found my records at the Field Artillery headquarters. So I had to wait. Everybody that shipped out that day went to England. And I had to wait for 3 weeks for another batch of people to come in. We assembled to go out, and we got shipped to Italy, which was a 23-day trip over to the Atlantic. Newport News, Virginia to Naples, Italy. It was 23 days in a convoy.
And I want to hear about that. And I know you didn't have it easy. Three Purple Hearts certainly illustrate that. But have you thought about what would have been different had you not been left behind there? Had you gone over to England with everybody else?
I met one of my friends afterwards, and his report was most of them were killed, a lot of them were captured, a lot of them were wounded. There were very few that survived because they were in the main invasion.
So the guys you trained with are guys that were hitting the beaches of Normandy on June 6th?
They were in Normandy, and they were in the first wave, the way I understand it.
So that would have been you, and you and I wouldn't be talking right now.
Exactly. Well, there were survivors, but who knows? God only knows what would have happened.
And we're going to get into the close calls that you survived. But that long ride to Italy, 23 days on the ship, what kind of things were going through your mind?
Really, not too much thinking, because we're in the ocean. Nothing to do but look at the ocean, play cards, play dice, and your thoughts are, what's going to happen? What's in the future? You can't speculate what you don't know. Reading the books that I did when I was a kid at the libraries gave me some forethought what it was going to be like. And it wasn't exactly like that, but it was still horrifying to think about it.
What was your relationship with your fellow soldiers like? What kind of guys were you serving with?
It was a mixture, but we all unified ourselves because we knew we had to be together. You got my back, I'm going to take care of your back. So you trusted them. Your trust has to be in your friend or your member of your squad.
What was the role that you were assigned to?
I was a private first class, but once we were assigned to the unit, Rome was captured on June 4th, I think it was. Shortly thereafter, I joined the division as a replacement.
This is the 88th Infantry Division.
They were offline at that time. I joined the squad, which was Company E, 349th Infantry Regiment. They assigned me to be a BAR team leader. Myself and two other men carried the ammunition, carried a BAR, which weighed about 19 and a quarter pounds, and protected the flanks or whatever the firepower was needed.
How much responsibility did you feel there? And did you have any idea what to expect when you hit the beach in Naples?
You're amazed at the destruction that we saw when we got there. Naples was still a lot of ships were sunk. Debris all over the place, the buildings are still bombed out and everything. But it hit us, what are we getting into? Going into the replacement depot, you see all the countryside, how destructive the war had been to that part. And then we were going to go into further north too, because we were assigned to a replacement depot that was about 20 miles outside of Naples, where we stayed for a few days before we got assigned to a company or a division.
Do you remember that
first taste of combat, the first time that you had to put that BAR to use, and in doing so became a pretty significant target of the enemy?
Well, yeah. You remember those things because you had to set it up and position it so you could be able to use it to the best advantage with it and give their best protection where it was needed, wherever the firepower was needed. Sometimes on the flank side, sometimes right in the middle of the fighting zone or whatever, because you had to make sure that you get enough firepower against them and still protect your side of the line. You have experiences with it. Get used to how it shoots and everything. You never shoot it automatically, so you have to fire in bursts of three, because that way you don't want to waste them. You only got 20 rounds in a magazine, and you don't want to blow it all on one shooting spree.
What did you know, or what did you expect from the other side, from the enemies that you were contending with, these German forces?
I knew they were going to be shooting at us just as bad as we were going to be shooting at them. We never walk into a town not expecting some firepower, or walk in the countryside not expecting some artillery fire or fire from the fields, the cornfields, the vineyards, or hidden bunkers that are out there. And you're always on edge for that. You have to be looking at it, that there's somebody's going to be out there trying to take advantage of that.
You mentioned earlier your brother in the Philippines was killed in action in 1944. So were you in Italy while this happened? And
I was in the hospital when I got the telegram from home.
Well, I'll keep it in chronological order then. Tell me about how you ended up in the hospital. This was the first of your three Purple Hearts?
Yeah, I got wounded and they shipped me back to the hospital, pulled some fragment out of my ankle, and sent me to a recuperating hospital.
How'd you get hit? Where were you? What happened?
We were fighting out in the open, and I don't know how I got hit because I didn't feel anything. There was excitement of the fighting. I didn't know it was hit until I started feeling my shoe so wet inside. And I looked down and I seen blood coming out of my boot. And I called for a medic. They patched me up, sent me back to the back to the aid station. From there, they sent me to the hospital. But I didn't know I was hit until I felt some pain and felt my shoe all soggy. It had been raining, so I figured it was bit because of the water. But when I checked it out, my socks was all red with blood. And it got me back to the aid station.
Did that get your attention at all? Did that make you feel a little more susceptible or vulnerable?
Definitely, because artillery has no conscience. It can hit way over here. You can be over here and a little further away from where it hits. But a shell breaks up into so many little pieces, big pieces and little pieces, that anyone can hit you. That's what hit me on my ankle, a piece of shrapnel.
So you're in the hospital recuperating, trying to get better so you can go help your buddies some more, and you get word from home that your brother has been killed in this same war.
Yeah, that was notifying me that he had been killed.
That had to be devastating for you. I can't imagine what that felt like.
It was very devastating. Yeah. Well, the staff was real good. You know, they understood. So they kind of left me alone in my sorrow. But they were all understanding, and they took care of me, you know, to my benefit.
And I know you had plenty of motivation already. I mean, you had a clear purpose you were fighting for. The world was at stake here, but I imagine that made it more personal for you. Did that give you more motivation to win this war and also more motivation to make it home to your family?
I'm motivated to be safer. To keep them out of danger as much as possible, but it's impossible to say, well, I'm not going to go out there because I know they're going to be shooting there. You had to do it. You had to continue the war as it was, as a fighting soldier. You had to go out and do it again. There was ups and downs in there.
And I imagine it had to be hard to be so far from home knowing what your family must be going through back home.
That was very true. But your thoughts are there. And the letter would take, I don't know how many weeks we go home between the connection, you know, communication, even with the V-mail. It was a little faster, but it was still took a long time to get back and forth with letters.
So you heal up and you go back to your outfit, back on the BAR?
Yep, still go back. They saved it for me. Two different people were assigned to me because the other ones had been wounded too earlier. So we separated and then never came back to the squad. So when I went back, they put me in my same position as a BAR team leader, with two new men that I have to, you know, get reacquainted and trained, and to see what kind of action that they would be giving or what kind of backup they could give you. But yet, you know, depend on your teammates.
And I mentioned that that was only the first of three times that you were wounded during the war. What was the second?
Again, shrapnel. We were in a firefight, and the Germans were in front of us, and there was a valley to the back of us, and we were in the hillside looking down in the valley, but the fighting was in a town which was in front of us. We were in the crest of the road, of the hill, and their shell was hitting down there in the valley because our troops were moving up on that side. And I was in a hole upstairs looking toward the town where the enemies were. And my friend, one of my mates there, jumped out of the hole hollering that he was wounded. Jumped out of the hole, and I seen that a hole about the size of a fist, out of his cap was gone, you know, from where the shell hit, where shrapnel hit him. And he got out of the hole. I pulled him back down, hollered at the sergeant. The sergeant said, well, the aid men are busy, so get him and take him back to the aid station, which is about 150 yards in a farmhouse to the other side.
We're going to stop right there for a moment. It's break time. Mr. Ramirez followed those orders, and that nearly cost him his life. We'll pick up where we left off when we come back. But first, I want to send a big thank you towards Selma and General Manager Rick Hoffman and the fine folks at Swanson Farney Ford and the entire Farney Automotive Group. You may have seen or heard their advertising on this, but for every car that they sell in August, the entire month, they're going to make a donation to Central Valley Honor Flight and help get our World War II veterans to their memorial. You know how passionate I am about that. Their example there at the Farney Automotive Group caught the attention of another business, which has now become our newest sponsor here on Hometown Heroes. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest this time, Ruben Ramirez of Reedley, California. He is 88 years old, and he served with the Blue Devils of the 88th Infantry Division, wounded three times as that division fought through Italy. When we left off, he'd been told by his lieutenant that all the aid men were busy and that Ruben would have to go carry a wounded soldier to safety. Tell us what happened next.
So I got him and calmed him down and got him in a fireman's carry and started down and away from the crest of the hill so that the enemy won't see me until I got into an open field. And then we were running across the open field when I felt a pain in my hand and in my thigh. And I fell down and I told the guy, I'm dropping the packs here because we were all loaded down with packs. So it says, so, and then we'll make it the rest of the way. But in that time, there was sniper fire coming at us. So he said, we got to get up and get out of here. So we finally got him into the aid station, and it took care of him right away. And then they asked me if I wanted some dry socks to take back to the guys. I said, yeah. I said, yeah, because my shoes are all wet and full of water. And again, I looked, I took off my boot and the blood had run down my leg. And I said, okay, let's take a look at you. So the aid man looked at me and said, no, you're not going back out. I lost my pack. I lost my souvenir pistols. Lost everything that I had in the pack. A personal being, you know, things.
You had left that in the field just trying to make it there, right?
Yeah, so somebody else picked them up and got the pistols, and I hope they shared whatever it was what they wanted. Because, you know, it's all personal stuff that you pick up along the way and you keep for little souvenirs. But I had taken a .32 caliber Walther off of a German officer. Earlier, when we were walking up the road and there was a farmhouse, the lieutenant tells me, take your team, go and check out that farmhouse. Wait, they're walking in the road. So when we get over there, we start hollering if they're in there to come out in English, you know, and in German, comes to see here, you know, try to make some kind of communication. So two soldiers came out with their hands up, and we took them aside, and then we start saying, anybody else in there? And then this officer walks out with his hands up, and two other soldiers come out with him. So there was five people in there, and there was only three of us. But when he approached me, I told him, you know, in front of me, we started searching down. I got the pistol off of him, and I lost that. That was a personal thought to having that.
The thing that strikes me, and I know you're not patting yourself on the back, you're just telling me what happened, but so often we hear these kind of stories, and when you're in that situation, you do what you hope the other guy would do for you. But I'm struck by a verse in the Bible. It says, greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. And you almost lost your life trying to save someone else's.
Well, it happens like that, but you don't give that a thought, though. You do what you have to do, especially somebody wounded like that, because he was really hurting and he was bleeding good, and I just had to get him over there. There was no other thought of doing nothing else but getting him there.
And for those of us who haven't been in a war, haven't been in a combat situation, we can't understand it the way you do, but I'm curious, did that anger you? Because obviously you're upset that you got shot. But when you thought about the fact that you're not a threat at this point, you're just trying to carry a wounded soldier to an aid station and someone shot you in that process, did that anger you? Did that seem out of line even in a war situation?
No, I didn't give it a thought to it. I'm a soldier. I'm an enemy. I can become his victim. If he can shoot good, he's going to get us. If not, well, my thought was just getting him, my friend, to the aid station. And no thought of the consequences in between, because you do what you have to do. Like I say, your stamina is going, adrenaline. Your thoughts are just to accomplish one thing, and that was to get him from point A to point B. Consequences in between is something else that are not predictable.
So you've told us about two times being hit by shrapnel, and neither time did you really realize what had happened to you. What about the third? What were the circumstances there?
Oh, it was a shrapnel from a mortar. We were online advancing, but we stopped at a farmhouse. Some of the guys went into the farmhouse. Some of the guys went to the barn to get some rest, cook up things, clean up, or just relax or something. And I told my sergeant, well, I'm going to go over to the house to see some of the guys. So I was walking across the barnyard when three mortar shells came in there. And I was in the middle of it, so all I did was take off. And just run to the house and got in there. And then I told the guy again, you better check me out because I feel some blood running down my leg. He looked and said, well, I can't tell if there's any metal in there or not, but you're bleeding pretty good. You're going back to the hospital for x-rays to make sure. Patched me up, put me in the ambulance back to the hospital, took x-rays, kept me for a couple of days, sent me back because they didn't find no metal in there. You know, they just sewed it up. And sent me back in a few days. I got a few days rest out of it anyway.
It makes me wonder what all that did to your outlook. Because here you are, your brother's been killed in this war. You've been wounded three times. Moving on from there, were you scared that the next time was going to be worse? Or did you feel like, you know what? Nothing's going to happen to me if I can take care of all of this.
If you say that you're not scared, you're crazy. Because you have to be scared no matter what. You anticipate, if it's going to be combat, you know, you start the fighting, you have to anticipate if one is going to hit me now or later or what's going to happen. But to say that you're not scared, it's just a poor saying that you don't realize what you're in. I say I was scared, and everybody tells you that they weren't scared in combat. I'm not going to say they were liars, but...
You know, this show, I always hear the firsthand account of a particular veteran, but sometimes it's helpful to understand the big picture, too. And in the case of your division, the 88th Infantry Division, those Blue Devils, you guys have a pretty impressive history in Italy, especially during World War II. Over the years, as you've gone to reunions and talked to other guys from your division and you've read about it, what do you appreciate most about what you, in conjunction with all these other guys, were able to accomplish?
Well, we did fight one of the tougher divisions of the German Army, and they gave us a lot of credit for being such good fighters as far as that goes, overall for the division.
And that's where your nickname came from, right?
Right. The ferocity of the fighting that they first went into surprised Axis Sally, who was a propaganda broadcaster. Those Blue Devils with those patches were too ferocious to fight, you know, that they were... They hated to come against the division.
Those blue clover leaf patches on your shoulders is what she was referring to. And obviously, if the division adopted that as the new nickname, I guess you guys took some pride in that description, huh?
Everybody was proud to be able to, here comes a Blue Devil. Yeah, I got a jacket with it says that and everything. And I was at this AMVET convention this past month, and I wore it over there. And they looked at it and said, what's that Blue Devil do you have there? And then I turned my back and I have them read the back because it says 88. Division Association, and it has the patch. It says that's what it represents.
And from what I've heard from other veterans from that division over the years is that it was pretty nonstop action, right? I mean, you guys saw a lot of days of combat. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. You know, we fought three different combat zones. The first one was Romarno, and then we fought the Po Valley, and then we fought the Apennines battle. So that's three different combat zones. And they were like all lasted maybe 2, 3, 4 months in between, on and off, on and off. You went in reserve to rest and take care of it, and then you go back on the line, and somebody else would come off the line to rest up.
Well, I want to get to the Apennines and some of the things I've heard about that, but when you talk about those three times you were wounded and the time that took you off the front lines, have you ever thought about that, that maybe... As painful as it was and as scary as it was, you were actually fortunate to be wounded when you were? Did it take you away from stuff that could have been worse?
When I got back, a lot of the guys were gone. They were either killed or wounded. And you go back to your squad, they're all new faces there. And you have to get familiarize yourself with them and to know them and see what they are and how they think and everything. So you go back, your whole squad might be gone. When you're just assigned to a squad. Like one time that I came back to the company, I was supposed to report to my company, the E company. Instead, the guys come and said, you're going to G company. I said, no, I don't want to go to G company. They need replacements. They need them now. We can't stand and argue that you're not going to go because that's where you're going. So they picked five guys that were returning to send them to G company. So they go over there, report in and everything else. And next day, we're new people in their company. We don't know them. They don't know us. They put us on a patrol to go out on a patrol. Okay. The lieutenant points to me and says, you're Lee Scout. Okay, fine. Get me a Tommy gun, because if I was Lee Scout in my company, they'd give me a Tommy gun. He said, well, we don't have Tommy guns for you. You have to use your rifle. So I said, I can't be a scout with a rifle. So we discussed it back and forth. I wasn't to argue. We discussed it back and forth. And I seen a corporal with a Tommy gun. And I said, he's got a Tommy gun. He's not using it. I can carry it out there and bring it. If I'm lucky, I'll bring it back to him. So he goes and gets the Tommy gun. He gives it to me and says, you're Lee Scott now. I said, okay. So we take off and over through the hills and the road. We go through a town. And there's a bluff on this side. Then there's a road. And then there's a valley. And as I come out of the town and down the road, make a curve, there's a hut on the side of the road over here, and I see Germans going into it. So I flop at the ditch right there at the bottom, next to the bluff that's there, the little ditch, and sign for tell the guys to stop back there and everything. Lieutenant comes up, and I tell him what I saw, and he says, well, hold attention here. Don't fire or anything. Just watch. And then he said, I'm going to take part of the guys that run through the valley and go around it before we do anything. If you hear firing, then you start firing. So as they're going advancing down there, a German gun is up on a hillside, already sighted at him. They started firing at them. I waited to see if he was going to holler or anything, but he didn't. And I said, well, if they're firing down there, it says there's Germans in the hills. So I started backing up and telling the guys to run back. So we go running back the road into town, and we're going down the road, and this machine gun starts firing right down the center of the road. If he were to move it 1 inch to either side, he could have got everyone, but it went right down the middle of the road. Then we got to a wall. We flop in behind the wall, and we waited. It stopped firing. We make a dash across the road, and we got it up behind the wall. And the lieutenant turns around and says, you go back and check that guy that's laying over there. I said, what guy? I thought I was the last one. He said, well, there's a man down over there by the wall. So go and check to see if he's wounded or what's his condition. So he gives me about 5 little vials of morphine in case he's wounded. So I dash across the road. Nobody fired. I checked him out. He was dead. So I got ready and then dashed back across the road again to the east side. And then we went to town and set up a defense position for a counterattack in case. But we waited about an hour and they didn't do anything, so we started backing out. It was getting dusk, so we returned to our lines. But of course, you're a new man in a company like that. That's what happens. You have to be the first one to be exposed. But 2 days later, I get back to my own company.
That must have been a sigh of relief just for the comfort level you had with them, huh?
Yeah, because I got to see my friends there, because they got more new replacements come in, so they were assigned over there. And we got them sent back to our company, which was a relief for us. We got to rest for a couple of weeks before we were in reserve.
Tell me about the Apennines campaign. What was the fighting like? What were the conditions like? Because I've heard some pretty awful stories about the weather conditions, the terrain, the enemy. How did you experience that?
Once you got out of the Po Valley and into the mountains, you're fighting rain, you're in fog, you're in total black darkness. You don't know where they're at. They know where you're at. They're up higher and they can see where we're progressing along the roads, because you have to stick to the roads, and there are very places that you can get away from track climbing a mountain. But the worst experience was being up in the mountains, and you're on guard duty at midnight. Pitch black, you can't see your hand in front of your eyes, like in front of your face, and it's foggy. You hear the water dripping off of the leaves, making noises. Your senses become acute to hear what kind of noise are you hearing. You can't see anything, but you hear a particular dripping on this side or rustling on that side. I mean, I was scared of the dark. I have to sleep with a nightlight. I have to sleep with light.
Today you do, because of an experience 70 years ago.
I can't sleep without it. If I fall asleep when it's dark, when I wake up, I get a panic attack. The worst part is I make sure the lights are on.
That's something you've just had to live with ever since the war?
Yeah. I sleep with the lights on outside. I sleep with the night lights inside. It's something you can't say. Turn it off. You can't turn it off.
Oh, I know that is not easy to talk about, but thank you so much for telling us about that. It's hard for us to grasp what veterans have dealt with. In many cases, like yours, nearly 70 years living like that. Thank you for making it all real for us. Ruben Ramirez of Reedley, California is our guest. The rest of his story when Hometown Heroes continues after this. The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selzler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Ruben Ramirez of Reedley, California. Pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook to see what he looks like now and what he looked like when he served with the 88th Infantry Division, an all-draftee division during World War II. He spent his time battling elite German troops in the mountains of Italy, wounded three different times. When we left off, Ruben was telling us how hard it was in the dark of night and how those experiences nearly 70 years ago still affect him in a palpable way today.
When there were times you actually got to sleep, I imagine the conditions you had to deal with weren't very favorable. Were you digging a hole on the side of a hill or what?
Yeah, wherever possible, find some defensive position where you could be safe. Or if there's a barn or houses around that we can get into. All we had maybe a blanket or a coat or jacket, something like that. But one time we walked into a factory that had nothing but rolls of cloth. The guys just cut them up and put them on the floor and fell asleep on them. They ruined a lot of material there, but that's the fate of war for whoever owned it. Because we wanted comfort. We didn't want to sleep on a wet floor or a hard cement floor. So they just cut pads about 3-4 inches thick to lay down on. Nobody ever reprimanded us for that.
Probably slept a lot better that night.
Yeah, I was more comfortable because usually I would fall asleep with shoes on and everything, all my clothes, and all I had to do was cover my face because if I kept my face warm, the rest of the body would be warm.
One of the things I've read about and had other veterans tell me concerning the 88th Infantry Division is that a good chunk of that division was still fighting at the end of the war. Some of them even after Germany had surrendered. Where were you for those first 8 days of May?
As soon as we stopped fighting, we went into occupation in a small town. The Germans had called Brixen. In Italian, it was Bressanone. And we went into occupation there. We had guards on the road to get any Germans coming down the road or going up the road if they're trying to go back to country. What we did, if they come down the road, we'd put them together and send them to a prison camp in the Po Valley.
So there were still Germans coming out of the woods after the surrender had been signed?
And one time, there were three of us that had a little German Jeep, and we went out riding down the road. We made a curb, and there was a column of German tanks coming down the road. And it's a good thing we're not fighting them now, because right away they stopped. We pulled to the side of the road, and we waited for them to start passing us. Comrade, cigarettes. They wanted cigarettes, you know. And I guess there was a captain or a colonel at first tank. He spoke beautiful English. He asked how to get to a point of surrender, you know. And we told him to go on into town, to the center of town by the railroad station, and they would take care of him. You know, in the time the Germans were going by, got any cigarettes, you know. They were friendly at that time because they weren't fighting. And there was about 8 tanks in that line, in that convoy, plus all the manpower they had. But it was amazing, you know, just to see the power that they had with those tanks. And you think, we had a fight against that. If they would have had that in some of our positions or some of the battles that we fought facing us, you know, it was awful. 88 millimeters. It's a loud bang, you shoot, and then it's a hit right away. It's a high-velocity rifle, and that would scare the pants off you. It did one time, too, because we were in the slope of a hill, and the lieutenant told us to dig in, so we made our trenches there, foxholes. And we were there for half of the day, and it started to get dusk. All of a sudden, a tank across on the other hillside, further away from us, we saw a tank on the skyline, And we just said, well, I hope they don't see us because we're in the forward slope and they can see us as well as we can see them. And they shot at us. So right away, the lieutenant hollered, let's get out of here, but let's move. So there was the first casualty of a war that I saw, because one of the friends was in the hole and a shell landed right beside him. And there was nothing left but of him but the corpse, the body. Everything else was cut out.
So just his torso, everything else was blown away. And so that's the worst thing you had to look at in the war, is that what you're saying?
There, but for the grace of God. Yeah, that always with me. But we got out of there, and some P-47 came flying around, and they spotted the tank and shot at him, but I think the tank got away from him.
Was there much celebration among your ranks when you found out the Germans had surrendered?
Well, not just a lot of shouting and shooting and everything else. And some guy had a bunch of flares that we shot them up in the air, but they got mad at us for that because they started fires. They didn't like that when they landed. They started some fires.
I know you had that occupation duty there for a while. I imagine you encountered occasionally some Italian civilians. What was that like? Did they express some appreciation for what you guys did?
They treated us nice. First days, they were very accommodating as far as going to give us wines. They always gave off of the wine. And some people would even bring in bowls of spaghetti. As we stayed there, the longer we stayed there, we developed a connection that we would give them our clothes for laundry and stuff like that. And then pay them with cigarettes or with bread or whatever we can get from the kitchen with food for them, you know. So they were taken care of, but we took care of them, and they did the work for us.
When the war in Europe ended, and I know you had that occupation duty, but was there a concern on your part that you might get sent to Japan?
That when they tried to get me to re-enlist right away, they start offering, making me a sergeant and giving me a bonus and everything else. Then it hit me. I said, no, if I do that, then in the war in Japan continues, I'm going to end up there. That's the only thought that I gave it then when they started offering. But I told them I had my discharge points already, because we got to discharge an amount of points you got for being overseas and stuff like that. So when I told us, I don't care what you offer me. I got my points. I'm ready to go home.
And what was it like to go home? What do you remember about that?
Well, pretty quiet. The family didn't expect me to show up when I did show up, but they were very, very happy, celebrated. You know, they'll come over for a big dinner and everything else. Then one thing during the occupation in the town, the colonel moved herself headquarters into the hotel there, and he wanted sentries at the door. So he had a battalion inspection, and he picked 12 guys for guard duty. Spick and span, he wanted the best, I guess. I was one of them that he picked, you know. So we had to stand at the door a couple hours, and we were off for a couple of the rest of the day and stuff like that. They stopped doing that, and I was going to report back to my squad when another battalion inspection came out. He couldn't get military police in there, so he wanted to get special police to patrol the town with some Italian police. So again, he had a big inspection and everything else, and again, I was one of the guys they picked to be on that special police, which we did nothing but just walk around town. One day we walked 4 hours, we were off the rest of the day. Next day, we walked 2 hours, and we were off the rest of the day. The third day, we were off. We didn't have to report to anybody. But we had a lieutenant in charge of us, and that's all he said, I don't care what you do. I just want to know where you are and how I can get you as fast as I can if I need you. It's all right. So that's all we had. We could go to any company we wanted to eat at their facilities, go over there and watch the people training and everything else and make them jealous of us. That lasted a couple of months. We were bivouacking at school, so I reported back to the school, threw my bag on the floor and had to report to the sergeant. And I heard him and the lieutenant talking, and the lieutenant asking, has everybody gone to Venice for their leave, 2 weeks leave? So the sergeant said, yep, everybody's gone, sir, and I got my records all set up. He said, and I hollered, I haven't been to Venice. The lieutenant said, who's that? The sergeant looks at him, oh, that's Ramirez. He's just reporting back for special police. Has he gone to Venice? The sergeant says, no. Get him on the next truck. So I didn't even unpack my duffel bag. I just threw it on the truck, and I was out of there to go to Venice for 2 weeks. I met some guys there, Air Force guys, that we chummed up to go around traveling and everything, sightseeing. spend time on the beach.
I think you earned all that with everything you went through before then. And speaking of what you've been through, you mentioned having to have the lights on at night and all of that, something you've dealt with for most of your life. How hard was it after you came home to get back into the swing of things, to adjust to civilian life again after this had been your existence for all this time?
It was hard because I'm classified with PTSD. When I got discharged, nobody said anything about PTSD or mental fatigue or anything like that. All they said was, if you're wounded, make out a claim. So I did. But nothing about the mental condition that we came out of. Not like they're taking care of the Vietnam veterans now. I've gone through the whole track of sleepless nights, nervousness, dreams, anxieties, everything connected with it. I went through that coming out of the service the first few years there, but I never knew what was wrong with me. You know, I was obsessive. I was on the edge all the time and hollering at night, getting up, giving a security check. And finally, when I met Tony Pacheco, he started with my paperwork. And that was in 2008 that it started. So actually, I missed out all those years that I should have been covered for it. But not knowing about it, I had trouble with my wounds. I went to the Long Beach Hospital, but they never asked me anything else except taking care of the wound. But if they would have had anything to do mentally, they could have put it on paper, then my claims would have gone back that far. But since it wasn't, it had to be investigated and everything else, and I had to show proof and everything of what I had. So 2008 was as far as they went.
What kind of difference has it made for you these last 5 years to actually have that recognized, to be able to talk to other guys who've gone through the same thing? What has it done for you?
You get peace of mind. Every other Tuesday, I go to the VA, and we have a session with World War II veterans only. We just talk, express ourselves. And every Friday, I go to the VA for an hour, and there it's a general session with PTSD patients. And you have the Korean War, you have the Vietnams, and I'm the only World War II in there. That's, again, expressing yourself and what you go through for the week, the sleepless nights. I show my nails when I have an anxiety attack. I show my tail, this is what I do when I'm getting excited. I know when I'm going to have problems, I start messing with my fingernail. And sometimes I carry a fingernail file, so when I know I'm feeling something, it occupies my mind, takes my mind away from what's getting me excited. And then I'm short-tempered. Sometimes little things irritate me, like people. And I know it's going to come, so I have to be able to block it. I hate to, instead of going into it and going into a tantrum and insult people or anything, try to walk away, try to, like we say, we bunker, go into our own little self to bunker. So we're out of the situation until it's over.
I'm glad you're able to share that with us, because so many of us have no idea some of the things that people like you have been through. And really, you did it for us. You put yourself in that situation for our sake. So thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us in a real way about what you've dealt with. You have those regular meetings. I understand you're pretty busy here in Reedley, too, at the Senior Center. What do you do over there?
Volunteer every morning at the Senior Center for lunch for the Senior Center. I do the recording to order the lunches and check them in when they come in for lunch, and my friend there does the serving of the food and everything. But I'm also chairman of the Senior Reedley Seniors Incorporated.
Why do you do all that? What do you get out of it?
Keeps me occupied half of the day. And I don't have to sit in front of a boob tube all day. We have painting classes. I joined a painting class, which I had never painted before. We have our pastor, Harold, there. He likes to paint. He's a good painter, and he's an instructor. And then, like he says, you can't make a mistake on it. It dries, we'll paint over it. You'll never know. Don't be afraid to do what you want to do on it, because it can always be corrected. But we keep busy.
Have you been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. yet?
Not yet, but I'm on a planned trip for October.
What do you think that's going to be like to visit this memorial, not just to you and 16 million Americans, but the centerpiece of that memorial is 4,000 gold stars signifying 400,000 Americans, one of them your brother, who died in World War II. When you think about that number, you think about going there and seeing that, what does that signify to you?
To me, it was a shameful loss of life to it happen. But it happened because the mindset of other people that couldn't talk things out and be more thoughtful of the civilization. But it happened, so it had to be done. Luckily, we were better than they were.
And I'm not trying to make you more emotional. But this is so real, and so many of us today go along with our lives and we don't realize what people like you went through. And when you think about your brother and you think about your own life and the things you've had to deal with, do you ever think about your brother and who he would have been, what he would have done in his life, what kind of difference he would have made?
I do think about that. I've thought that a lot. He was a good leader. We always had a bunch of friends around with him. That's where his little Hank and Big Hank nickname came out, because he had a lot of friends.
Well, Mr. Ramirez, we're out of time today, but thank you so much. I'm so excited that Central Valley Honor Flight is going to get you to Washington, D.C. and the World War II Memorial. The stories you've shared with us today give us a little perspective on what that memorial is all about. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and thank you for being here.
That's Ruben Ramirez of the 88th Infantry Division. Next time, we're going to hear from a veteran who served in the 87th Division and survived 16 weeks missing in action. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.